It's Physical Therapy Day on WPR News. I am Jill Nadeau. Thanks for joining us. Physical therapist Jill Tine-Nissenbaum and Lori Tine-Brody are back with us. Jill is a professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison, and Lori is a physical therapist and an athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. Hi, ladies.
Good to be here.
Hi, Jill. How are you?
I'm doing well now that you're all here. We'll start by talking about gluteal amnesia, also referred to as debt butt syndrome. I thank you both for having me making me say that on air. We'll talk about what causes weakness in our posterior muscles and how to strengthen them. What questions do you have for our guests? Join in by calling 800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Now, I heard about this on the news a little while back, but why don't you explain what gluteal amnesia actually is?
Yeah, sure. So this stirred our interest because there was a New York Times article a little while back about gluteal amnesia, and Jill and I always love the opportunity
to talk about dumb butts.
Dumb butts, or strengthening your butt muscles. And I'll start by saying that I see a lot of patients, and I can test their strength, and you know, their muscles may test strong, but they don't use them. They don't activate them when it comes time to function. And so they're not even aware that they're not using those muscles. So, you know, they say, well, I can do, you know, I can go to the gym and I can do 20 squats. Well, that's great. There's a plethora of research showing that you can do a squat without activating your glutes.
Right.
So it's not, can you do a squat, but how do you do it and what muscles are you using? That is important.
Right. And the gluteus maximus is one of our largest muscles in our body. And so anytime you do something, for example, something functional like going from sit to stand or going up and down stairs, you should be recruiting this muscle. If you don't, and you only use your quadriceps, as Lori alluded to, you're going to have muscle imbalances, and that can actually lead to things like knee pain. So one of the questions I always ask my patients is, you know, when you did those squats, where were you sore the next day? And did you feel it in your butt? No, I felt it all in my quadriceps. Okay, so you're not recruiting your gluteals when you're doing this activity. You're not engaging them.
Right. So, and there's a lot of research out there on different activities that can activate these muscles. But as always, it's how you do it that matters. It's not, do you do a single leg squat or do you do a Romanian deadlift or a step up or a clamshell? Like every patient I see does a clamshell.
Right.
But you can do it correctly or you can do it incorrectly. So just doing a bridge. Bridge is one of the classic exercises that's recommended for gluteal strengthening. If it's not done right, you will come back with back pain.
Right. So I think all of these things are really important, is not only consider the exercise itself, but there's so much, for lack of better terms, cognition that goes with this and mindfulness to make this automatic. So there's a huge learning aspect to this, and making sure that when you do these exercises, and right now I'm squeezing my glutes, I don't know if you guys are, but when I do these exercises, I have to cognitively think about it before it becomes automatic. So there's a big motor learning component to this, I would say.
So what can happen if you just, you know, let your butt go dead? I mean, what's the bad side of this?
I would say the number one thing that I see is low back pain.
100%.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So, and I see a lot of people with low back pain. That's one of the largest populations that I see. And I typically start them off with some very straightforward, straight plane exercises. And it may seem simple, but what I'm mostly doing is watching how they do the exercise and seeing how they substitute. And I will tell you that probably 80% of the people, when I ask them to do an exercise that primarily requires hip, they are shifting their weight and leaning forward back side to side, and they're using their back. Because
right.
That is, as Jill said, it's cognitive. It's their automatic program. Instead of using their hip muscles, they default by shifting their weight or using their back.
We're really good at that, aren't we?
Yes.
If one muscle's weak, we just use a different one.
We take the path of least resistance.
Sure.
So
exactly.
That's just exactly. Our mindset.
So as they say, neurons that fire together, wire together. Mm-hmm. So if as Jill said, it's
not
cognitive.
A lot of people say that.
No, I haven't heard that for a while.
You haven't?
Okay. All right. Not at my dinner table.
My apologies. So it's something that goes through my head all the time, and that is everyone has sort of motor programs. So it's like you get on a bike. Maybe I've ridden a bike for a few years. You don't need to think like this is I engage this muscle and I do this or I do that. You have a pre-existing motor program in your head that says ride a bike, and it contains all the necessary information for you to be able to do that. The same thing happens with going from sit to stand, from going up the stairs, or doing any other activity that you do. If your motor program does not include using your gluteal muscles, then you will continually reinforce the wrong motor program, and the wrong neurons will wire together, and it'll be hard for you to figure out how to use your glutes. So that's why you see a physical therapist or someone to ensure that you're actually using the muscles you're supposed to be using during exercises.
So what are the symptoms then?
Well, I think a weak glute is a contributing factor to many other conditions. So I don't know that people necessarily come in and say, I have a dumb butt or I have weakness in my gluteal muscles, sure. But it's more, I have low back pain. And when you observe them moving, you see that they're using their erector spinae to extend versus their gluteal muscles, or they have patellofemoral pain in the front of their knee under their kneecap. And same thing, gosh, I do all these exercises and I feel like it's always in my quadriceps. My quadriceps are painful, but you don't have that posterior chain involved. So I don't know that they come in and complain of the glute as much as it's a symptom of many things in the lower chain.
With the exception of people who have had total hip replacements.
Oh, there you go.
Because I see people, especially people with a posterior approach, where they take down the glutes and they come in and they no longer remember how to fire their gluteal muscles. You can see asymmetries left to right because of the weakness that has resulted from the activities that took place during that surgery.
When you said take down the glutes, what does that actually mean in layman's terms?
So they go through the gluteal muscles to do the surgery. Mm-hmm. So the gluteal muscles are impacted directly by that surgery.
Okay. Now it sounds to me that if you're somebody who does sit a lot, which is one of the things that can cause this,
yes.
right? And you're having back pain, mm-hmm. that maybe it would be a good idea to see a physical therapist because, as you say, you're doing exercises, but you're not necessarily engaging the correct muscle.
Yeah, you're not doing the right one, or you're overloading the system. And so, similar as the neurons firing, as Lori said, I can't carry that load. My glute says I can't carry that load, so I'm going to make another muscle do it, or another muscle jump in and help. Mm-hmm. So for all those reasons, we do. And I say, you know, you're kind of a puzzle, and we have to take the pieces apart and identify which pieces are having difficulty and maybe treat them in isolation before we put everything back together and use the movement collectively.
Okay. And then you had mentioned earlier, too, that even if you're like a runner or someone who is very athletic, that doesn't necessarily mean you're using those muscles, right?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. We see that all the time. And okay. that contributes to some of the symptoms we see when they walk in the door.
Okay. Now, how is this, these sluggish glutes, different than like when your hands or feet go to sleep?
So this isn't as much numbness and tingling as a motor program, as Lori alluded to earlier, where you just forget how to fire them. So when we sit for a prolonged period of time, we're actually kind of changing the length of the glutes. They're a little bit on stretch. And then you go to stand up and you've changed the length tension relationship, and your glutes may say, oh, I don't remember how to fire here. I don't know what I'm doing. And so those first few steps, after you get up from sitting for a prolonged period of time, you kind of waddle like a penguin, things like that, until your muscles say, oh, I remember I'm supposed to kick in. So that's kind of a common symptom, I think, of gluteal amnesia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. I've seen that. And it seems like the older you get, the more you're likely to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So what's the cure for that?
Well, getting your glutes firing. So you can, you know, when you stand up, you do a squat, if you put your fingers back on your glutes, you should feel them firing when you go from sit to stand. Or oftentimes we'll have people do an exercise where they they are above a chair and they're lowering themselves down almost to sit. So you can put your fingertips on your tush muscles as you go down and back up and make sure that they're firing. And if not, you know, you need to talk to somebody about helping you do that. But sometimes tapping in that area can help activate them so that they know what they're supposed to do.
So if you're sitting in a desk all day, get up once an hour and walk
least.
Around and maybe
yep.
do a couple up and down in the chairs.
Yep, absolutely.
So one of the things I like to cue, and Lori will talk a little bit about this, kind of how you fire these muscles, is one of the cues I give people for squatting to get them to fire their glutes is I tell them to pretend they're standing on a newspaper. And of course, there's a lot of people in this generation that are like, what?
mm-hmm.
And they're standing on a newspaper. And when you come up from your squat, push your feet out as if you're trying to rip the newspaper in half. And that recruits some of the glutes, similar to some strategies that Lori likes too.
Oh, yeah. I can feel that.
There you go.
Just
right.
moving my feet.
Right.
See?
So I'll have people put a resistive band mm-hmm. around their knees. And mm-hmm. as they go down, they pull it out. Mm-hmm. And as they come up, their knees come back in, so they practice activating their glutes as they go down and up.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It's one of many things we do.
All right. Anything else you want to add to that? No? Okay.
Not at this point, but we'll probably get into some other exercises
for sure.
as we
Absolutely.
Go through the show.
Okay. That sounds good. I'm Jill Nadeau, and we're talking with physical therapist Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum. If you have questions about glutes or other parts of the body, give us a call at 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. And this is a Larry Mueller Show. At 12:30 today, we're going to talk to Madison relationship and sex therapist Margaret Berg about improving communication and connection between committed partners. But right now, we're talking about physical therapy, and we do have a caller waiting, Julie in Eau Claire. Thank you very much for your patience. Go right ahead.
Good morning. Well, I've never had knee pain in my life, and didn't fall. I don't know what I did. I've had this since late May. The only thing I can think of is that I was climbing up and down ladders for quite a bit, but not crazy-like, but I was, because I had a leak in the house. So I was climbing up and down ladders, and it comes and goes. I have good, even while I'm laying in bed, I'll have, and it goes from, it's the back of the knee is the worst, and it goes down the leg that my leg feels like heavy even. I went to the doctor. She couldn't feel anything. Took 3 x-rays of the knee. Didn't show anything at all. And she recommended try a physical therapist. So I was just wondering what you think about that.
Did you see a physical therapist?
No.
Oh, okay. Is there a reason why?
No, well, I'm just thinking about it. Okay.
Oh. Okay. Yeah. Well, Julie, having this since May and not improving is probably time to see a physical therapist. It could be your knee. It could also be coming from your back. I mean, my first thought was maybe a little meniscus tear mm-hmm. in the knee. But climbing a ladder, there's so much side bending and rotation. Mm-hmm. It could be coming from Julie's back, too.
Are you getting any swelling in your knee?
No, but it does feel good to wear a bandage around my knee. In fact, like this morning, I go for like a mile walk and up and down and bike ride. I'm very active all day, and it doesn't make it hurt more.
Okay. That's
all
great.
Right. Yeah. So I agree with Jill. I think going to see a physical therapist to sort out the cause of your pain. So, you know, typically a meniscus tear, a little degenerative tear, we would expect some swelling. Mm-hmm. We also expect that it might feel better with some compression.
Right.
So it's hard to tell, but they can also do an examination and examine your back and see if they can elicit your symptoms with any specific tests that would help point to where the cause of the problem is. So I absolutely think you should see physical therapy because, as Jill said, if he was going to get better on its own, it would be better by now, and it is not.
Right, especially being fairly active. It sounds mm-hmm. like, you know, you're doing a lot of things right, and mm-hmm. we don't want this to deter you from continuing with your activity.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Let us know how you do,
yeah.
Julie.
Thanks, Julie. Let's go to an email. William says that as a paraplegic, he gets a burning sensation in his glutes, and he's wondering if there is an exercise or therapy that would help him.
Oh, wow. So this is not a population that I treat.
Me
so
neither.
It depends upon the level
of his paraplegia.
So that would be the first thing. And whether he has any activation of his
Correct.
Glutes, depending upon the level of his
he
paraplegia.
He gets a burning sensation, he said.
Yeah, my guess is that if I had to say anything, I would say it's a pressure issue
Correct.
From sitting so long.
Right.
So I expect he has a Rojo cushion or something mm-hmm. like that. But I guess if I had to recommend anything off the top of my head, not being a neuro PT, I would recommend doing dips, lifting his
Unloading.
Bottom up
Unloading.
To unload his bottom. My guess is that it's more due to the pressure and the constant weight bearing than it is anything else.
And along those lines, it may be that he needs a new cushion.
Mm-hmm.
He may, if he's had a change in weight, mm-hmm. body type, weight distribution, he will need a new cushion. Maybe it has somehow his cushion is fit in his chair. And all those things are something that a physical therapist who specializes in treating patients with neurological conditions could address.
Mm-hmm. And wheelchair fitting as well.
Yes.
I mean, it's not unlike a runner whose shoes wear out. You know, you start to get symptoms from
right.
shoes wearing out. So, yes, absolutely the same thing could happen from your seating.
Okay. And if he wants to find a person who specializes in that, is there a place mm-hmm. to go?
So, sure. Just like there are orthopedic specialists, things like that, there are people who are neurologic physical therapist, so you could call any clinic and ask to see the individual who sees patients who have had experienced a spinal cord injury or have paraplegia. It's usually a neurologic certified specialist.
Okay.
And he's probably seen someone in the mm-hmm. past for mm-hmm. his wheelchair fitting
oh,
and
yeah.
things like that. So
yeah.
he may already have established care and just not seen this person for some time.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you, William. Appreciate that email. Let's go to Kathy in Madison. Go ahead, Kathy.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I really enjoy the physical therapy shows and always learn so much. I am a recovering Guillain-Barré patient. 3 years ago, I woke up on a Sunday morning and I couldn't move my legs. I was hospitalized and spent quite a bit of time in the ICU. The paralysis gradually spread up my body to my arms and my breathing, and it was kind of touch and go for a while, but I am fully recovered from all of that, and I walk. It took a long time to get my strength back and to be able to walk confidently again. After I spent time in two different rehab hospitals, I came home and had in-home PT from a wonderful person who really worked with me on strengthening my legs again. The muscles had all just atrophied. We never talked about the glutes and all of that. I only really learned that from a subsequent exercise class that I take online and somatic yoga, which both focus on the glutes in almost anything we do with our legs. And I've discovered that I have residual numbness in my left leg, and those glutes are so weak compared to the other leg, and they just don't seem to get better. I keep working, but I wonder sometimes if it's ever going to really fully be as strong as my other leg. I don't know that you have the answer to that, but I find it most interesting that in the beginning, there really wasn't much discussion about the glutes, and now I know they're so important to like
okay.
everything.
All right, thanks, Kathy. Go ahead.
So, yeah, my guess is that the physical therapist was working on those and incorporated those, but maybe didn't talk about them specifically. But I expect the exercises you were doing focused on that. You know, at this point, you've got this side-to-side imbalance, and I don't know how long it's been since your original hospitalization. But, you know, at this point, I would expect you to be doing some single leg stuff,
right.
trying to get the left to catch up to the right. So, for example, the single leg bridge or a lunge or a single leg squat. you know, if you're not able to do that, you know, so for example, in a bridge, you could do a two-legged bridge to raise up and then lower yourself down. So I usually start with the eccentrics on the single leg component. You know, if you haven't seen anybody for a while, and I understand you're going through these exercise classes, maybe you need a visitor to with somebody who specializes in neuro PT mm-hmm. to do an assessment of that left side and give you some very specific direction of what to do, in contrast to the classes which are, you know, geared to a more general strengthening program.
Right. And I was looking because Guillain-Barré, the symptoms typically start distally mm-hmm. and move proximally, but I didn't know residually if it was more impacted in more truncal muscles or if peripheral muscles were more long-term affected, and I couldn't find anything.
The only people I've seen have been more distal.
Okay. All right.
But that's a limited sample.
A very small sample size, yeah. Yes. Okay.
Okay, Kathy.
Thank you for sharing your story.
Yeah, that's where I would go with this, Kathy. Yeah. Just to, because you're working very hard and you're working with a trainer, getting a little bit of help that's specific to your situation mm-hmm. from someone who specializes in that area might make better use of your time in your exercise class.
Okay, thanks, Kathy. Appreciate that. Jeff and Cornell, you're up next. Go right ahead.
Make better use of your time in your exercise class.
Hey, Jeff, are you there?
Justin Cornell, you're up.
Okay, well, we'll wait for him to turn off his radio and come back to his phone. Let's go to Christina in Glenwood City. Hi, Christina.
Hi there. Thank you. I am a left-handed person who uses my right hand to scroll on the phone, and so I've developed pain in my right thumb. I don't know if it's a joint or a tendonitis. I believe in exercises and PT 150%. And I also wonder, should I ice or heat it? Any suggestions?
Well, try and cut down on your scrolling, first of all. And I know that's a really hard thing to do. So it's interesting. I'm left-handed as well, and I was just trying to think how I scroll on my phone, and I use my left hand. So are you scrolling with your finger or your thumb? Your thumb?
I'm scrolling with my thumb.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
All right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it could
one
be
one of two.
Right.
One of two things.
Yeah. It could be a little bit of arthritis in your carpometacarpal joint, or we could have a little bit of
De Quervain's
tenosynovitis mm-hmm. From that thumb business. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It could be either one mm-hmm. for
yeah.
sure.
Yeah. So I would see somebody to sort out which of those two things it is and get you some recommendations on what to do. You might need something like a thumb spica mm-hmm. splint for right. a while to get that to rest and calm down. But someone who's a hand specialist could sort out whether it's OA or De Quervain's. It's pretty easy. So De Quervain's, Jill just did it while she was sitting here. You didn't see it, Christina, because it's the radio. But if you take your thumb and your right hand and bend it across your palm, then wrap your other fingers around it like a fist, and then bend your wrist towards your little finger side. Ouch.
I know, it hurts on a lot of people.
It does hurt. It hurts on a lot of people. But anyway, I'm not having symptoms. But if that really hurts in the same place that it hurts, then it's De Quervain's.
And you could have a combination of both.
And
bracing or getting that thumb spica splint would be good for either.
Mm-hmm.
But that's kind of where things change. If it's degenerative changes at your carpometacarpal joint versus a tendinopathy, then treatment will change differently. And Lori had mentioned seeing a hand therapist who could be a PT or an OT.
Mm-hmm.
So certified hand therapist can be either.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I would see somebody yep. before this gets out of hand.
Right.
Pardon the pun.
No, we're not pardoning that.
Oh,
I'm sorry.
Yeah,
you're guilty of that. We're talking to our physical therapist. Our regular ladies are here. Lori Tyne Brody is a physical therapist and athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. And Jill Tyne Nissenbaum is a professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy Programs at UW-Madison. Do you have a question for them? Give us a call, 800-642-1234. We've got open lines, people, so now's your chance. Or you can send us an email, too. That's talk@wpr.org. So earlier, ladies, we were talking about the people who sit at a desk.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the other things that they can do? Is it an ergonomic thing, too, that you have to be concerned about?
Well, ergonomics are always important. I'm not sure how much they are a contributing factor to gluteus as much as just the whole fact that we're a sitting society.
Mm-hmm. And the hip flexor muscles, we haven't talked about the hip flexors, but the hip flexors that are on the opposite side of the joint from the gluteal muscles, when you sit, those things are shortened. So Jill mentioned when you're sitting, your gluteal muscles are lengthened. Yes, the muscles on the opposite side of the joint are shortened, and so it makes it that much harder to activate your glutes. And all it's also important to note that your hip flexor muscles attach to the front of your low back. So for people who come in with back pain, we always check their hip flexor length, because that can be a big contributing factor to back pain, especially in combination with weak glutes, because the glutes aren't strong enough to counteract the tightness in the hip flexors.
So one a very simple exercise that I give a lot of people are in sitting with your feet on the floor. Everybody should think about trying to squeeze both of their gluteal muscles together at the same time. And you might like pop up a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And then try and do just one. Do just your left, just your right. Mm-hmm. Do they fire? Is it easier to fire one side than the other?
I like to give my patients, like who can't figure out how to fire their glutes, something to think about. And I tell them, I hope this is okay, Jill, that they're holding in a fart in a movie theater.
Oh, I say trying to stop a fart in church.
I know. I didn't know if the religious part was politically correct.
100%.
So I said a movie
theater.
Yes,
a movie theater's
so
good. But I say
holding in a fart.
Holding, that's what I say. Trying to stop flatulence is a very good cue.
Yeah, because everyone knows how to do that.
Yes, well.
But then trying to do one side versus the other, I think, is a little challenging. And does one side work better than the other? This would be a really good test for Kathy, our previous caller with Guillain-Barré, who had that side-to-side difference, to see if she feels she can recruit one side better than the other.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you for taking us down that train. Larry goes to Scotland, and then everything just goes, you know. They're taking over. Let's go back to Jeff. He's called back in Cornell. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Hi, so recently I've been having some knee pain, mostly on the side of my knee, just kind of here and there. I also get kind of a tight pop in that knee when I extend it at times. I know I don't have much butt muscles. I've always been told I have a bony butt since I was a kid. But I'm curious if that could be causing that pain in the knee. And also, I also have some real tight hamstrings that may be causing that as well. Just curious of your thoughts.
So when you say you have pain on the side of your knee, is it on the inside of your knee or the outside of your knee, Jeff?
It would be on the outside.
On the outside. So you're thinking like IT band. IT band. Or something. Mm-hmm. If he's got tight hamstrings, he might have tight lateral structures as well.
Yep.
I agree.
So it's possible that it's contributing to your pain. The question is it just one side? Why is it just the left side? Or is it both sides?
It's one side.
Yep. One side. Okay. So anytime you're asymmetrical, we wonder what's different one side to the other, which is why we typically tell you to go see somebody.
Mm-hmm.
Because it could be a leg length difference. It could be a pelvic rotation or upslip or downslip that's contributing to that. It could be related to how you move or your activities. So people who are doing one-sided activities are always moving one direction or preferentially using one leg over the other as part of their vocation or avocation can be a contributing factor. So when we have a joint that's having symptoms like this without a known cause, such as I fell down the stairs or I tripped over my dog, it gets a little harder to sort out the underlying cause. And that's why we often suggest that you see somebody, and sometimes a visit or two to sort that out can be helpful. Can it be related to your glutes? Absolutely, especially the iliotibial band part, because it attaches to the TFL, the tensor fascia lateral, which is part of your gluteal muscles, so that all that is connected, especially the gluteal muscles on the outside, the gluteus medius. So it can absolutely be part of the knee problem. But again, I want to know why it's on one side and not the other.
Yeah. So seeing someone would be good.
Yeah.
It's the why.
It's the why.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Great. Thanks, Jeff. Lori in Madison, go right ahead.
Hi. I am a 62-year-old with a 10-year-old ACL repair on my right knee. I have now developed hip joint pain. I mean, it feels to me like it's bone on bone. I know that's not likely what it is, but that's what it feels like on the same right side. Sometimes pain coming down and a little knee pain as well. So I guess I'm just looking for what possibilities or exercises might help. I do Pilates. I have a rowing machine that I use. I walk. But I would say right now there's a little hitch in my stride.
A hitch in your get along?
Yeah, just a little bit. And, you know, sometimes it feels like I can feel tendons sort of moving, like you can just kind of feel like a little snap in the hip.
Are you able to use your rowing machine right now? For example, can you get all the way up into the catch or that start on the rowing machine without difficulty, Lori?
I can, yeah. I can do that. I can do, you know, all the Pilates movements on the glider without a problem.
Are you having groin pain?
No.
Okay. Most primary hip OA I see manifests as groin pain.
Right.
So. Yeah. So when you tore your ACL, like what kind of injury was it? What happened?
I fell. I had jumped down from a ledge and fell and just sort of twisted it.
Okay.
I had it repaired. Okay. You know, went on with my day, was a runner. I've done some half marathons. And so, you know, I think it repaired fine.
Okay.
You know, and I was active so sure. that, you know, it does occasionally get stiff.
Mm-hmm. Right. I was just walking back to see if it was possible you had a labral tear at the time you tore your ACL, but you were so focused on your ACL.
Right.
And now it's catching up with you in your hip. So, you know, bone on bone, hip OA, you would have more pain and be more limited
if 100%.
That were actually the case.
Right, right.
So I'm not going with, like, severe hip OA.
No, but labral pathology.
Labral pathology could
definitely be the fact, especially if you hear things sliding around. Now, she could also just have an incredibly tight hip joint capsule where, you know, or hip flexor tendon that slides right over your femoral head right in front. You can sometimes feel that slide around.
That snapping hip.
Right, snapping hip. Mm-hmm. So it would definitely, you're in town. Mm-hmm. It would definitely behoove you to see a physical therapist. So you do so many things right. You're doing good cardiovascular activity. You're loading your knee somewhat, but you're also doing good cardio where you're not loading your knee on a rowing machine. So you're breaking things up well. You're doing Pilates. You're doing a lot of things right. But I think it would be good to see someone and see what we need to do from an exercise perspective.
Because there's a piece that's missing.
Yes.
There's a piece that's missing and somebody needs to take a look at you and figure out what that is and fill that hole so you can keep doing the things
Correct.
You want to do.
Okay, thank you very much, Lori. This is Larry Mueller Show on WPR News Network. I'm Jill Najoe. Our physical therapist, Lori Tyne Brody, and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum are back with us today. What questions do you have? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is the Larry Mueller Show. We're talking tomorrow to Wisconsin Tourism Secretary Ann Sayers about some upcoming fall events. And then in the last hour, we'll talk to UW Health Psychologist Shyla Morgain, and she's going to tell us what we all can learn from the mindset of elite Olympic athletes. And that's tomorrow starting here at 11. Right now, we got PT on the brain. And let's talk to John in Waterloo. Go right ahead, John.
Hi, good morning. About 3 weeks ago, I started experiencing this pain, mostly burning and numbness in the front part of my thigh. And I did some research on it, and it looks like it might be myalgia.
Peristatica. Very good. Very good. That was the first thing that came to mind for me, too.
Me, too. Have you been sitting?
It's worse. Sitting in the van for a while, when I get out, it activates it. If I'm active during the day, it's not a problem, but then if I slow down toward the evening, then it starts up again.
I'm going to ask you another question. So you only have it on one side, is that right, John?
Yep, it's just on my left leg.
Okay, so I remember when my sister got this. Mm-hmm. Right, Lori?
Yep, yep, yep.
She had an ill-fitting backpack frame, and it was putting a load on the outside of her hip. So are you wearing any tool belts or anything like that that could be a contributing factor to this?
No, years ago I wore tool belts every day, but now lately I haven't been.
Okay.
My guess is it's related to your posture sitting mm-hmm. in the van mm-hmm. for some reason. So, mm-hmm.
yeah. So neuralgia peristaltica is entrapment of the lateral femoral cutaneous nerve. I mean, so many big words, mm-hmm. and it is sensory only. So there's no muscle weakness with it. John, do you have any muscle weakness, or does it feel like it's all just sensory?
Just sensory.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So thinking about your posture, maybe you need to change your posture. Maybe you need to get a sitting wedge in your van, or maybe you're taking longer trips now. I'm not sure why, but changing your posture and working on stretching the front of your hip and taking your time when you get out to stretch your hip a little bit and move around, I think would be useful.
I'm not sure if I can describe this, but I can tell you how to floss the lateral mm-hmm. femoral cutaneous nerve. So it's going to be hard. So John, you got to visualize this with me. So visualize your left knee is bent and you're holding your ankle behind you as if you're stretching your quadriceps. Okay. But what you need to do is for 2 seconds, you need to kind of swing that left leg a little bit behind your right leg. So you preload mm-hmm. that and then come back out to neutral. So you got to be in a little bit of a staggered stance. You mm-hmm. might actually find little videos of it.
Your knee's going to swing mm-hmm. back and forth, mm-hmm. but you need to keep your stomach muscles tight. Keep your core tight so that you're not tipping your low back as you do it.
Mm-hmm. You might be able to find a video of it.
Yeah.
And if you're not turning the corner, I would see a physical therapist yep. and just rule out and make sure it's not anything else. Mm-hmm. Suspicious. Agreed. And talk about sitting posture, things like
right.
that with driving.
Right. Exactly.
Okay, thanks, John. Mark in Duluth, it's your turn. Go right ahead.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. So I have like hip on the out or pain on the outside of my hip, and I've been told, not by a medical person, that it might be bursitis. Is mm-hmm. that something that I'd see a physical therapist for, or more like a sports doc?
So it could be greater trochanteric bursitis. It definitely could be. That is the largest bursa in the body. So if you're doing something where you're sitting with your leg crossed or bringing your leg over midline and putting a lot of tension on that side, that could be a factor. Sleeping may be a factor if you're very thin and you're kind of going into a curve there.
It's pretty easy to diagnose because
it's boggy.
Yeah, yeah. So if you put your fingers on the outside of your hip where that bony prominence is, that's right where that greater trochanteric bursa lives. So if you touch that and it's really tender, then that's more than likely what it is. You could also have some gluteal tendinopathy where it attaches just around the backside of the femoral head slightly. So you would see a physical therapist for either of those. Mm-hmm. And we would want to know why, again, you're having it on one side and not the other, because we assume that both legs are doing the same thing.
Right.
So are you having symptoms on one and not the other? So did this just start, Mark?
Probably like in the last 6 months, you know, when I would sleep on my left side.
Oh, there you go.
You don't have to roll over and, you know, yep. because it was kind of painful. And it hurts a lot more when I've been walking a lot.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, yeah. That all makes sense.
It sure does.
Yeah.
And we haven't had the mattress talk for a few visits.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
so
yeah, yeah.
I believe you said, Lori, that some mattress expert called in and said your mattress should replace it after 8 years?
Yeah.
Eight to ten.
Eight to ten.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something to think about, Mark, as well, is do I need to consider a mattress? So be cognizant if you sleep somewhere else, if you go to a hotel or something, does it make a difference?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Although I don't know that changing the mattress is going to change the bursitis once it's stirred up.
Right.
So it's a little bit harder to get rid of if you tried icing it and things like that. But yeah, see a physical therapist and they can isolate that and give you a few more specifics on that. And if it doesn't get better, it responds fairly well to a cortisone injection. But I wouldn't go there first.
Mm-hmm. Okay, makes sense. Thanks, Mark. Frank in Madison, you're up next. Go right ahead.
Hi. I was recently diagnosed with, I'm not pronouncing this right, probably the Dupuytren's contracture on my left hand.
Oh, Dupuytren's contracture, yeah.
Yeah, so it's on my left hand. It's not bad right now, but I'm wondering if there's anything I should or should not do to slow the progress.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. You should see a certified hand therapist because that's what they do.
Right.
So a Dupuytren's contracture is an idiopathic, meaning we have no idea what causes it, contracture of the palmar fascia, and that's the palm of your hand, the thick fascia. And I've seen commercials for this lately.
Yes, I have too.
Yeah. So we don't know what causes it, but definitely seeing a certified hand therapist, and as Jill said earlier, either a PT or an OT, to get a baseline now. What are your measurements? They'll do assessment of your strength, of the range of motion of your various digits, and get a baseline, and then give you some recommendations of how to slow the progress of this. But the certified hand therapists are the real experts in this area. So I would see somebody now and get in, get established with somebody so that they can continue to follow you as this changes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, great question.
Okay, thanks, Frank. If you've got a question or a comment, give us a call, 800-642-1234. And, of course, you can always send an email. Don't make it too complicated, though. And that address is talk@wpr.org. Let's go to David in the Wausau area. Hi, David.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I had a ruptured disc in 2019 on the right side. I now have neuropathy in the outside of my right leg and foot. I still do things. I have skied the Berkey since then and whatnot. But when at work, I wear a pedometer. And when I put in more than 10,000 steps, I get in my quad, on the inside of my quad, that cramps up. And I try to stay hydrated, but I've talked to a couple of chiropractors and a physical therapist, and they're not really sure. They're saying that maybe I'm trying to compensate for muscles that aren't working. Any suggestions to get things working better?
So you had a ruptured disc, 2019. How was that treated?
They opted not to have me have surgery. They just said it's going to... I'm not sure the anatomical term or the medical term where it kind of hardens
resorbs.
And then
it's sequestered and, and your body reabsorbs and remodels it. And so, okay.
Yeah. So my guess is you have some degenerative disc disease on that side. On the right, you're getting a progressive collapse on that side and probably some narrowing where the nerve roots come out that impact your thigh, like at L4.
Yeah. What level was your rupture? Do you know, David?
One.
L what?
L5S1.
Oh, L5S1.
Oh, L5S1. Okay. Yeah. So that makes sense.
Yeah.
So, to me, what you're getting is a claudication kind of situation where the more you walk, what kind of surface are you walking on?
It's concrete.
Yeah. Well, there you go. So if you're on a hard surface like concrete, every step you take reverberates back up at 2 times your weight, okay? And all of that is going up the kinetic chain into your back. So you get to a certain point, especially in a gravitational loaded environment, where you're going to just get progressive collapse and narrowing of the opening where your nerve roots come out over time.
Does, David... If you sit down when you experience this pain on in your quadriceps and in your adductor muscles, does it go away?
No. What I usually get it is like at the end of the day, and it happens at the weirdest times, like I might just be sitting or even when I've laid down to go to bed, and it's a cramp. It's like the most, I almost can't even talk. It's almost funny because people are like, what's the matter? And it's a cramp. And it's just on the days when I have a lot of, you know, a lot of walking, whatever. And the reason I want to continue to do the Berkey, which is going to require a lot of, you know, distance training, and that right leg just isn't playing nice. It's not firing like it used to.
Have you seen a physical therapist since you had a herniated disc in 2019? Have you ever seen a PT
not,
for this?
No.
So it, yeah, you're getting a little complicated. Mm-hmm. You have a you know an extensive back history. You're very active. You are a good historian in that. I know my limit is 10,000. Then all of a sudden things start falling apart. You want to ski the Berkey. There's lots of really good PTs up mm-hmm. in your area, and it would be really good just to, you know, go in for a tune-up. You've
right.
managed
right.
this by yourself thus far, and you've done well, but now we're running into some kerfuffles, and we need to get them ironed out.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's all kinds of things in my head, like shoe wear.
Me
Is there
too.
A leg length difference where he's loading more on
right.
one side of the
Limping
other?
Limping after 10,000, fatigue.
You know, Berkey, I would be less worried about the Berkey because you're forward flexed, and the Berkey is going to open things up in your spine,
and it's not
impact.
Do you skate ski or classic?
Right.
Do you skate ski or classic?
I skate very slowly.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I definitely think mm-hmm. this would be worth seeing somebody, and just this, you have a pretty extensive history
yeah.
for not having any physical therapy rehab.
Right.
So yeah.
Okay. Get thee to a PT, David. Thank you, Christy in Chippewa Falls. You are up next.
Thank you very much. I'm calling about prolapsed uterus. I'm 69, 3 vaginal births. Very active, like your previous caller. Have seen a physical therapist for this. Following those recommendations, also saw an OBGYN, was fitted with a pessary, which I'm not so keen about. I've heard of two friends of friends who've had the surgery for the sling. To me, surgery is like in the far distance. I don't care for that idea. My primary physician recommended rather than standing with weight resistance, sitting. I try to visualize that whole concept of hoisting up internally. Recommendations, encouragement. I know I'm not alone on this.
No, you're not. So thanks for asking. When you said you saw a physical therapist for it, was it somebody that specialized in pelvic floor health?
Yes, very much so.
Okay. All right. So they did an internal exam and gave you very, very specific exercises for that.
Yes.
Did it help?
Yes, it definitely has.
Okay.
On my bridges, I just like using that gravity to put things back in place.
Okay.
I realize this is something to be living with, but am I missing anything? And at that whole surgery thing, I'm not so keen on.
Yeah, I would say if you're seeing somebody who is a specialist in this and who does this for a living, like does pelvic floor day in and day out, then I would go with their recommendation,
right?
Because it's above my pay grade.
Right.
We have people here who do women's health and pelvic floor all the time. And I think they would probably say the same thing, is that if you're seeing someone whose expertise is in this area, they probably don't have anything new to add to that. And I agree with you that if you can put off surgery, as long as your symptoms are not impacting your ability to be active, you know,
right,
we don't want you to stop doing things that help keep you healthy in other ways because this is limiting. And I absolutely think that getting several opinions on what is the right procedure and when is the right time to make that call would be really important for you.
Right. I don't think she's missing anything.
Yeah.
I think, yep, exactly.
Okay, great. Thank you, Christy. We've been talking with physical therapists Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum. What questions do you have? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau, and thanks for spending some of your day with us. We really appreciate that. Our physical therapist, Jill Tyne-Nissenbaum and Lori Tyne-Brody, are back with us today, and we've got full lines, so we're going to get to them right away. But if you want to jot this down, the number to call is 800-642-1234, and of course, you can send us an email. That's talk@WPR.org. So Dorcas in Sheboygan, thanks so much for waiting. Go right ahead.
Thank you. I am 74. I have mild cerebral palsy as an underlying thing, but it's very mild. 3 years ago, I fell and broke my hip, got a hip replacement, did what you would think, a few days in the hospital, a stint in the nursing home, getting PT, more PT at home. It all took a little longer than average, but it started great. I was doing well. And then one of the physical therapists agreed with me when I said, it feels like one leg is shorter than the other. So, of course, I went back to the orthopedist and we did x-rays and everything looks, on the x-ray, it looks just fine. I do better if I put a lift in the opposite leg. That's the one that feels shorter. And at this point, I did not use any cane or walker or anything prior to the hip replacement, but I do now. When I walk without something, I look like Chester from Gunsmoke, showing my age there. But I definitely have I had a slightly awkward gait before, okay. But it was very mild. Now, walking without a cane is impossible. I have seen a physical therapist to get extra stuff. I went the last or extra exercises and work on it. Nobody has had any ideas until I did. The last time I saw a therapist was about a year ago, mostly for working on balance. Mm-hmm. Nothing has changed this feeling that one leg is shorter than the other.
Okay. Well, that's because it is. So it is pretty standard procedure after a hip replacement where that side will be longer than the other side. So is your instability related to the leg length difference, do you think, or is it related to something else?
I think absolutely.
Okay, so then...
Why would it look fine on the x-ray? That seemed odd.
Oh, because they only look at the hip joint itself. So they take an x-ray and they look at the hip joint and they say your surgery is perfect and it is at your hip joint, but it's standard procedure that leg will be longer afterwards. And I see people with legs that are quite a bit longer and some that are a little bit longer, and the response I typically get from the surgeon is, oh, it'll even out on its own.
Or you'll accommodate.
And it does. It evens out because you get pelvic asymmetry or you get back asymmetry. You get a little scoliosis. So it is accommodated usually at a proximal joint that is on up. And then we see them for those symptoms. So... as controversial as it might be with the surgeons, I tell my patients to put a heel lift in because it prevents issues down the road. Typically, I am told, and correct me, Jill, the surgeons say they lengthen it because they want to make sure that femoral head is well seated into the acetabulum. Yours was 3 years ago. You are not going to dislocate at
correct.
This point.
Correct. And typically, if you have a leg length discrepancy, everybody has a little bit of one, so you don't have to correct for the whole thing. You correct for about half of it. And the other thing I'll tell you is I don't give patients a heel lift. I actually give them a whole insert that goes into their shoe so they're not just in plantar flexion and get tight calves. And there's a great website that you order these from and you don't have to do right or left. You can flip them over and they're these clear plastic and you literally peel them apart until you find the height that's for you and you throw them in your shoes and you're done. So I agree with Lori on all of this. With with your, I know you said your CP is mild, but that may just have enough tone mm-hmm. and enough difference that mm-hmm. this is manifesting magnifies a little bit more mm-hmm. for Dorcas than mm-hmm. another individual.
Yeah, yeah.
So I agree with all of that.
Yeah. Yeah. You are not wrong that you have a leg length difference. And if it is causing you symptoms to the point where you walk like you're on gun smoke and you have to have an assistive device, then I say you work with a lift in your shoe mm-hmm. to stabilize you. Because right. the last thing we need is for you to fall again.
Exactly.
Because you are asymmetrical.
Or end up with all sorts of gluteal pain or gluteal right. tendinopathy because of the way you're walking.
Exactly.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks for the call, Dorcas. Let's go now to Manitouish Waters. Go ahead, Lori.
Yeah, hi. I had developed an inflammatory disorder over the last couple of years and has been on multiple courses of steroids, especially high-dose steroids this summer. I recently started a biologic, so I hope that's not a medication I'll have to take again. I'm pretty active at 64 in terms of hiking and kayaking and lots of gardening and lots of yoga. I'm probably the most worried a little bit of having lost some muscle strength and also my bones after so many courses of steroids. Do you think that the yoga I do is enough, fairly intense yoga, for weight bearing, or is there something else I should add on?
No, it's not enough, because you need, for your bone health, you need odd forces. And Jill loves talking about odd forces. It's one of her favorite things, so I'm going to hand it off to her.
We have weird things we like to talk about. You should hear our Thanksgiving table. So odd impact is what helps your bone stay stimulated. So just like anything, muscles accommodate, so does bone. So you need to train these muscles in different ways. So yoga is great, but doing things like walking backwards, sidestepping, doing a karaoke or a grapevine, doing ballroom dancing, all of those things where you're accelerating and decelerating and moving your lower extremity in various angles are what is going to help you load your bone the best. This is why you can see a stress fracture in a cross-country runner, because they do the same thing day in, day out. They load their bone the same way, and after a while, the bone says, oh, this is no big deal, and they start to break down. Versus someone like a soccer player who accelerates and decelerates and changes directions all day long, we don't worry about stress fractures in that population. So I don't think, it sounds you're active, which is great. I think you need, I would see a physical therapist to get on a really good strengthening program you could do at home to probably complement your yoga, and then talk specifically about bone strengthening, if it's via walking, different programs, things like that. So I would definitely, hiking is great, but you're going to need to add more to it than just hiking.
Right. And again, with an inflammatory disorder, having someone who has knowledge and understanding yes. of how to dose activities in the presence of a chronic inflammatory disorder would be really important, because the last thing we want to do is send you into a flare that's going to require cortisone again.
Right. Okay, we did get an email from Sue. She said that she's a retired pediatric physical therapist, but not an expert on adult ortho or neuro issues. She has self-diagnosed the numbness and tingling in her lower legs as small fiber sensory neuropathy. Now, the symptoms developed over a long time, and she says that the issue has not resulted in weakness or imbalance, but she would like to know if there's anything that she can do to alleviate the symptoms.
Generally, no.
Right, unfortunately.
It's one of those things that neuropathy, small fiber neuropathy, idiopathic, and, we see it in people who have diabetes, but other than that, it can be idiopathic, and there is, unfortunately, not a lot
right.
that can be done for that, other than some medication to help with symptoms. But in terms of physical therapy, there's nothing that we can do to treat those issues.
Okay, thanks, Sue, for the email. Jane in Appleton, what can we do to help you?
For about the past, first of all, I'm 88. When I'm feeling, when I'm not having a problem, I walk a mile or so every day. I do chair yoga on Zoom, and I do folk dancing once a week. For about the past week and a half, I've developed some pain in my left knee on the inside. It doesn't bother me when the knee is in a straight line, but it bothers me when there's any kind of twist.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds probably like a medial degenerative joint disease or medial meniscal tear, which is, would probably be relatively normal in someone who's 88. That twisting motion is really hard. That torquing motion is hard on your knee joint. So if you can avoid those kinds of activities for now.
Although the folk dancing has a lot of twisting. That's probably the does. Problem. That's so the walking's probably not the problem.
You might try a pull-on knee sleeve that has an opening or cut out for your kneecap. Just a, you know, just a simple elastic pull-on knee sleeve and see if that helps give you any relief from that. But in general, when you're doing your folk dancing, try not to pivot on that foot, but try to take small steps to turn. And it is like dancing. So a lot of times what we see are people when they're doing dancing things is they're like spinning or pivoting on a foot. Try to think, I don't want to pivot or spin or twist on that foot, but I want to take small steps to turn instead and see if you can get this back under control.
Right. So instead of keeping your foot planted and twisting your body, always take lift your foot up.
Lift your foot up. Yeah. Well said, Jill. Thank you for clarifying that for me as I stumbled over my excessive number of words.
That's okay. Thank you, Jane. We appreciate that. Claudia and Eau Claire, go right ahead.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yep, go right ahead.
Okay, hi. My question is, I had a foot injury, couple hairline fractures, third, fourth metatarsals, and impact and twisting. That was 4 years ago, and ever since I've had some difficulty. Currently, I'm experiencing still pressure of one point, and it was diagnosed as a bursitis bursa, on the bursa in the foot, the right foot, and it's constant. And I have also had some kind of radiating, usually at night is the strongest pain up, is it the Barrabus muscle or tendon?
Peroneus.
Outside of the lower leg.
On the outside? On the outside of your foot?
Yes, that's the term.
Okay, Peroneus brevis.
And your question, Claudia?
Where is there a bursa by the Peroneus brevis?
No. That's just a secondary thing from. The main thing is the bursitis is on the bottom of the foot in between like the third and fourth metatarsal.
My question is a neuroma, they say.
Yeah, I was going
to to diagnose and really know, but that's
okay. Well, thanks, Claudia. Our connection's kind of bad here. So
you have a neuroma and some peroneal tendinopathy.
Right.
That's what I got so far.
Right.
Did she have a question or did we lose her?
I think
her?
She
did
wants to know how to remove the pain.
Oh.
So.
Okay.
Yeah, go ahead.
So there's a lot going on here. So she's got a history of some foot fractures, things like that. So classically, if somebody has a neuroma or a Morton's neuroma, it's usually between third and fourth metatarsals, and it gets squished or compressed if you wear a shoe that has a really tight toe box. Hers could be getting compressed with scar tissue if she's had some surgery or some sort of trauma to her foot. So she may have multiple reasons she's having this neuroma. So did she want to know?
I think she said that she had those hairline fractures as a result of an impact and twist injury to her foot. So so she could have some scar in there from that. Because if you have an injury that's significant enough to cause a fracture in those bones, you also injured the soft tissue in the area.
Right.
So chances are she's got some scar there that can be related to causing the neuroma.
Absolutely.
So looking at foot posture, footwear, mobility.
Right.
They will do injections in that area to see if it can calm things down.
And I'm guessing throughout this whole process, she had to have seen a physical therapist because she had been immobilized for a while and had gone to rehab.
Right.
So
right.
I don't know if it's a revisit back or if this is a newer condition. But,
and I expect she's seeing a foot and ankle specialist.
Correct, a surgeon.
For this too.
Right.
So those would be the cover the bases. So I'm not sure. The peroneus brevis tendinopathy may be related to how she's walking and moving.
For sure.
So if she hasn't seen a PT to assess that, that would be a good place to go. I would see a physical therapist who specializes in foot and ankle. So, you know, Jill and I are sport board certified sports specialists. There are orthopedic specialists, and then there are people who sub-specialize in foot and ankle.
Mm-hmm.
So if she could find somebody who does that, people who look at feet all day long,
right?
That would be useful.
Right.
Okay. Thank you, Claudia. Sue in Stevens Point, go right ahead with your question.
Good afternoon, ladies, and thank you for taking my call. I'm a 77-year-old female. I've had three children. Coincidentally, three knee replacements. I tried to do... Yes, I know.
There's a correlation for sure.
I'm trying to get that connection.
Laura, you're in trouble.
Yeah. Exactly.
I try to do silver sneakers three times a week, Pilates once a week. I believe I was born with the occult spina bifida. My tailbone was broken during the delivery of my first child, and I have spinal stenosis. And now I'm starting to walk with a stoop, and it's not a good look for me.
No.
Any suggestions?
Oh, yeah.
It's not a good look.
It's not a good look. Yeah, you're far too young to be a bent over.
Stenotic person.
Yeah, exactly. So I would get you in a pool if I saw you, because it's hard to hold yourself up against gravity. When you have stenosis, your back is telling you, please lean forward because I feel better. So given your three knee replacements, your fracture, your stenosis, I would want you exercising in a pool as part of your program. So seeing a physical therapist to get exercises at home, working on your glutes and your lower abdominals, all that would be key.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Sue. We got an email from Mindy. She said that her 71-year-old father recently had knee replacement surgery on his right knee. He did not have a positive experience with his first few PT appointments following the surgery, so he stopped going, but is exercising at home. And what Mindy wants to know is if doing the recommended exercise at home is sufficient for healing and recovery.
That's a great question. Right. It depends upon how diligent you are with those. You have a relatively short window, I would say of no more than 12 weeks, to regain your knee range of motion. And you want full extension and you want flexion to 125 degrees. So I'm not sure why things didn't go well with this first physical therapist, but if you're unhappy, see somebody else, but don't stop or you're going to be...
Right.
In deep doo-doo.
Right. And it's, you know, we don't know if the first visits didn't go well because they were really pushing range of motion, which is really important or whatever. But you're absolutely right. You need to understand, as a patient, you need to understand the purpose of your exercises, why you're doing them. And if that wasn't, you know, clearly laid out for you and you weren't happy with your services, then find someone who is a good fit for you. I would hate to see something detrimental happen, like Mindy's dad need a manipulation or something because he's not getting his range of motion because he chose not to go to therapy.
Mm-hmm.
And he's probably not getting his exercises progressed
right
to meet how he is improving. So
yeah, it's if there was one surgical procedure where I wanted you in physical therapy on a regular basis, it would be following a knee replacement.
Yep.
Because the long-term impact of not regaining your range of motion is devastating.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well.
Maybe she wanted her dad to hear that.
I'm pretty sure she did. I got that feeling too, ladies. Let's go to Maureen in Madison. Go ahead, Maureen.
Hi. I broke my shoulder in October of last year, shoulder cuff, and I started physical therapy in December. The break healed well, and I've been doing physical therapy ever since. My range of motion has about remained the same since about February or March, but I have more pain now than I did in February and March. I can lift things, but I just get aches when I think the garden is what did it. Weeding, mowing, picking up sacks and everything. And I did have a steroid shot about a month and a half ago, and that didn't help at all. I keep doing physical therapy. I just wondered if there's anything else I need to consider. I'm going to see the orthopedic nurse tomorrow, and I wondered if I should ask about anything.
So did you tear your rotator cuff? Is that what happened?
I don't know. I mean...
No. I mean the initial injury. You said you broke your rotator cuff?
Well, the initial injury from the x-ray said that I broke my shoulder cuff. That's all.
Your shoulder...
I didn't think they could see tears in an x-ray.
No.
So
they can't.
Okay.
So she could have had a glenoid fracture. She could have evolved her attachment of her rotator cuff
on her greater tuberosity.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay.
So.
All right. So regardless of that, you're not doing as well as you'd like to, and the injection didn't help. And I think I'm glad you're seeing someone. I think this is really important. I think the things that you need to share with the individual you're going to see tomorrow are the injection didn't help. Here's what I'm doing from a rehab perspective. Here's what I'm doing for an activities of daily living perspective. And Maureen, how are you sleeping at night? Are you able to sleep okay or sleep a problem?
You know, I'm 79. I sleep in 2-3 hour segments, but it's not the pain that wakes me up.
Okay. So the shoulder is not impacting your, mm-hmm. your pain. Okay, that's a good thing, because a lot of people with cuff pathology complain of night pain.
Yeah. It's hard to know what's going on because we're not exactly clear what happened in terms of the fracture. And I assume it was treated non-surgically. You were just immobilized?
Yes.
And do you have full range of motion now? She said it hasn't changed since February, but we still don't know what it is. Is it full? Can you get your arm all the way overhead and you can wipe your bottom and hook your bra?
I can't hook my bra, but otherwise I can go overhead and what is the other one you said?
Wipe your bottom.
Sideways. I can go out. I can go out with a bent elbow. I can go out, and I have a weight PT that I pull out in and in out.
Right. Rotator cuff rotation.
Okay.
Yeah. So just be clear with them what things you're doing. And see if they can figure out why you're having more pain. Maybe it's related to your increased activity over the summer. It's hard to know, but you shouldn't be having so much ongoing pain at this point in time.
Right.
So
for sure.
Getting to the bottom of it would be important. The fact that your injection didn't help, and I don't know if it was a intraarticular or if it was a subacromial bursa. So.
Right. I would definitely mention the pulling weeds business, the gardening, because that's a lot. If we end up with like a little bicipital tendinopathy, that could be the case.
Yeah.
So okay. Mention that.
I just let the weeds go, Maureen. No, just kidding. Thank you so much for calling. We appreciate that. And ladies, thank you for being with us once again. We do appreciate that. Jill and Lori. We'll be back again next month. Talk about more some stuff.
Awesome.
Sounds great. Awesome. All right.
Lori Dine Brody is a physical therapist and an athletic trainer at UW Health Spine and Physical Therapy Clinic. And Jill Tyne Nissenbaum is a professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW Madison. And stick around because we've got another exciting topic coming up at 12:30. Well, anyone in a years-long relationship can tell you that intimacy can and will change. But with some patience and some compassion, you know, couples can find that closeness again. Hi, I'm Jill Nadeau, and this is the Larry Mueller Show. And joining us today is certified relationship and sex therapist Margaret Berg, whose private practice, Margaret Berg Therapy, is located in Madison. Margaret has nearly 30 years of experience helping couples work through issues relating to intimacy, and we'd like you to join in the conversation. Don't be shy. How do you and your partner stay connected and emotionally in tune with one another? Do you want advice on how to fan the flames of passion after so many years together? Who writes this stuff? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Margaret, thanks so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
You bet. 30 years, my gosh, you look like you're 25, so.
Thank you.
Are you sure you've had 30 years? Because, you know, we want to make sure that we have all the best people here.
Not quite 30 years.
Not quite yet. Okay,
but
see, I knew it.
Yes,
I knew it.
So. This is nearly on there.
Yeah. So why do intimacy, what is it, in an intimacy change in our relationships? What are some of the factors that fall into that?
Well, if you're comparing a long-term committed relationship, that's going to be different, feel different than someone like a friend with benefits or a fair partner or a short-term partner, a couple months or maybe even a year. It is theorized that the romantic stage of a relationship lasts anywhere from 2 hours is kind of the joke, but 2 months to maybe a year and a half before the power struggle sets in.
Sure.
And most folks feel like when they're in the power struggle that that's the end, and people might say, oh, I need to find a new partner, or you're not the person I thought I fell in love with, or who is this person? Mm-hmm. Like, you have totally changed. And really nothing's changed. You've just kind of gone back to baseline, because in the beginning of all our new relationships, we have new relationship energy. We have our brains are being drenched with neurotransmitter. There's a little like cocktail bartender in our brain that's like going, ooh, here's a little dopamine.
Right.
Yeah. You know, here's some oxytocin. Mm-hmm. Here's some norepinephrine. And so it feels really, really, really good. But we can't be in that place forever. Mm-hmm. And so usually people will find a new partner, but then they'll find that, oh, I'm ending up in the same pattern of relationship that happened the last time. I tried to consciously pick a very different person. I was set out to do it. I for sure thought I did. But now I'm actually feeling similar feelings, similar losses, similar unmet needs that mm-hmm. I was having in my relationship before. Why is that? That's because we all are not told that we have to go through the power struggle to get to a real love stage. And in the beginning, most partners are not having to talk about sex and intimacy. It's just happening. You're just colliding into each other, and things are just kind of taking care of themselves. And there's this myth that, you know, it's spontaneous, but it's really not. You're thinking about sex all the time. You're thinking about when you're going to get it with that person. You're thinking about, ooh, what panties am I going to wear tonight? Or, you know, what cologne can I wear? Or, like, you're planning things out all the time, and people have this, like, fantasy that, oh, it's just happening. So when the power struggle happens, it's actually a gift to growing up and becoming mature and needing to communicate. And most of us didn't grow up with models that talked about sex, that talked about, hey, come talk to me. Do you have any questions? We had models that were more shaming or driven by religion. And so most of us can't get around shame with sex and sexuality, and it feels dark and it feels heavy, mm-hmm. and we feel alone so much. And we just want to feel connected with the other. And we have no model for inviting us to talk about it. And it's really, really difficult.
Right. And a lot of this gets unsaid. So then what does that do when you've got these wants or needs or what have you, and you don't tell your partner?
Well, a lot of things can happen. You can choose to have like a parallel relationship and just not be connected to your joy and aliveness. And maybe find that through your children or friends or work or other exits in your life where you're finding joy. You might get a divorce and you might have an affair. You might open up your partnership to find it with perhaps somebody else as well. Or you might decide to talk about it. That's probably the most difficult, most challenging, most vulnerable route to go, is to talk about it, to find someone to help support you in it if you can't do it alone. And it's hard work. Mm-hmm. It is hard work. It's a vulnerable process, but when you're with someone and you're next to someone, you know, naked or clothed, and they're revealing themselves, you're being a safe enough object to allow them to fully emerge and express themselves. And I'm getting tearful because this work is very spiritual to me. Mm-hmm. And it's like at our essence, it's part of our life force, is mm-hmm. Where our spirit and our sex kind of just collide. And it's very connected to how we move in the world, is if we are connected to how we're feeling sexually or our sexual self-confidence or and it can look so different for everybody, but we have these very, you know, minimal sexual stereotypes that have been around that are just very old and are not helpful, and keep us in this place where we feel very inadequate and not alive, and we judge ourselves on other people or other relationships, and we really need to just talk more with our partner and see what they're thinking, because we're not sharing most of the time what our needs are. And
it's a very scary place to be for most people,
yes,
to reveal themselves like that. Now, how do men and women express, you know, this dissatisfaction with a relationship differently? Because I'm pretty sure most of them do, right?
Well, I would say most of it might come out in a defensive pattern, is how someone might express it, no matter what genitals you have, what gender you have.
Okay.
If you're feeling hurt and you don't feel safe to share, it comes out in a defensive pattern of blaming, shaming, criticizing, not curiosity, not wonder, like, oh, I wonder, like, you know, most people aren't great sexual intimate teams. You know, it's hard to, like, take something on. It's easier to blame and point a finger. And if something's going on in someone's sexual relationship and you're partnered, you're not on an island by yourself. You know, this is, you're a team and you're a system. And so if there's a challenge coming up, both of you have something to learn, to grow into, to stretch into, to reclaim from maybe childhood or some sort of heavy blanket that's on there that needs to be lifted, so you can be invited into a different place to emerge. Or to heal. You know, a lot of us are, there's a lot of pain with sexuality, a lot of non-consent that happens when we're younger, when we're adults. And if you don't have a voice, which a lot of us aren't taught that it's okay to have a voice in our family system, sex or not, it's just not safe. And so you can't expect someone to come out and be open and vulnerable when they don't even have permission to use a voice. Or they might be projecting that. You know, maybe their partner's open to it, but they're projecting that into the space. Well, I didn't have one before, so I'm assuming it's not safe to have one now. So I'm just going to be quiet over here. I'm going to accept the little crumbs that I get. Or, you know, a lot of folks don't want to have sex because the sex that they're having is just not worth wanting.
Yeah.
And that's not their partner's fault. We all have a responsibility to ourselves. Our arousal and our orgasm, if we choose to have one or have had one or know how to have one, it is our responsibility. It is never our partner's responsibility, our arousal, our desire, our orgasm. But that's not the model we're taught
with, that's
right?
That's huge, because
women are taught to please all the time. And I meet so many women in their 40s or 50s who are like, I can't say the F word, but they're like, F that. Like, and they come in and then their partner, who they've been with for a while, they're like, what's going on? I thought everything was okay.
Yeah.
You know, if we're talking a heteronormative couple here. And they're like, no, I want something more. I want something different. And that's just, it's so exciting when that happens. It's such hard work when that happens. And but there's like a shift that occurs. And then there's like hope. And there's something to gain and learn for, if you're talking about a heterosexual couple, the male-bodied person in this scenario as well. And this can happen in any gendered couple. There's always going to be, in any gendered couple, someone that has a higher desire for physical sex, someone that has a higher desire to keep gas in the tank, someone that has a higher desire to close the door when they're going to the bathroom, whatever it might be. It's no different with sex, but sex is just so sensationalized, and we have to create it, and advertising makes so much money off of making people feel inadequate about it, and it's just, it's sad.
Yeah, it is, really, because people are missing a huge part of what makes us human, right? This touch, this, you know, connection. So, excuse me, for those who have not had any kind of therapy or have been exposed to anything like this, what would a session look like? So, you know, if someone comes to you, their, you know, the partners come to you, what happens at first?
Yeah. Well, all living organisms thrive with safety. So it's up to me to create like a safe container for whoever's coming into the room, whether they're an individual or a couple. But we'll just talk about couples right now. We start with breath work. We start with getting grounded. We start with positivity. When we're with our partner long enough, we start flagging for negatives. We have a whole file on them, like, ooh, I saw you do that. I'm going to put that in. Just wait till I pull that out later. And so we need to really start being positive. We start every session with an intention. How do I want this to go? How do I want to show up? We take responsibility. We have some skin in the game. So you're creating an intimate team feeling. I have people share an appreciation for themselves or their partner. In the beginning, and then we go from there. We use the Imago Dialogue as a basis of grounding and connecting and feeling safe with one another. So it's a conversation, a give and take. It allows the brain to slow down, to not make up all these stories. It allows you to focus on your partner, to cut off your head and your ego and go over to their island and be a little curious about their experience, because we have this kind of symbiotic disillusion with our partners that they are supposed to know what we want and what we feel. And you know, if we didn't get that met in childhood, that need is still going unmet now, and but we're not conscious of it, and we expect our partners to provide that for us without opening our mouths, without expressing a need. And if we're not getting a need met by our partner, it's not because they don't want to give it to us, it's because they do not know how. And so we have to have so much compassion and curiosity about that. So that's what we begin with. We begin with positivity. We begin with getting a sense of, like, you and I are a team. I'm just really holding space for whatever needs to come out, to come out. I do embodied work as well. So I invite clients into their bodies and noticing and just really slowing down and paying attention to facial expressions, to tone of voice changes, to like, oh, what was that? What do you think that's about? Or, you know, just anything, because so often we're just in autopilot and we are missing out in present moment vital experiences that make us alive, make us feel alive. And we feel numbed out. And then we go to these other things that we think aren't going to help the numbness, which aren't usually helpful for us sometimes. And when we're missing that vitality, that connection right in front of us, we just don't know. We don't have a great roadmap there, because most of our models weren't fantastic.
We're talking to Margaret Berg. She's a certified relationship and sex therapist and a workshop presenter. What do you want to know about couples therapy? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. So as we age, our bodies change, obviously. How do you help people get past that, Margaret?
Well, I think it goes, like, even before that, our, like, kind of paradigm or lens of, like, what we think sex is. And we tend to grow up learning that, you know, sex is intercourse. And it includes a penis and a vagina. And it leaves out a whole other human race of people that end up being marginalized, and these sets of expectations, this kind of pass-fail scenario, and leaves a lot of people feeling inadequate. And it's interesting, Peggy Klein-Platz did this amazing study on optimal sexual experiences, and many of the people talked about how their favorite experiences where they felt most alive was when they were like fumbling around when they were in adolescence, before any kind of penetration of any sort of any genitals or body parts were going on. And just the that space of playfulness and creativity and maybe, ooh, we might get caught, and the, you know, illicitness that goes on with that. And so often when we're with someone, we get into this routine. First we do this, then we do this, then we do this. And then we might get old enough that actually that's not working any longer. And then a lot of people will just stop being sexual. And it's very sad. We're sexual when we're in utero. They find children touching their genitals for self-soothing in utero. And children go to their genitals when they're younger to touch because it feels good. Before children are self-pleasuring or masturbating, they're touching their genitals because it feels good. When they're sick, they touch their genitals. And oh, sorry, I just lost my train of thought. I'm like, I'm immersed in like self-pleasure right now. Woo! No, but we have this model of what sex is. And so it's really important to expand that. And especially as we age and as parts of our bodies aren't showing up as we want them to, or as we expect them to. So we really need to change our expectations. And no matter, I mean, it could happen earlier on. It could be a medicine that we're on. It could be a surgery that we had. It could be post breast cancer, or, you know, it can be vulvar pain. You know, so many people just stop having sex because of this very limited model about what we learn pleasure looks like. And it's so important to go throughout your day of allowing yourself little moments of pleasure that have nothing to do with sex, that have to do with sensory experiences and sensuality, because those are the building blocks for when you're not walking around horny, which a lot of women in long-term relationships, and some men as well, are not. That's just the norm. That doesn't mean anyone's broken or your partner doesn't love you or find you attractive anymore. That's just the norm. Mm-hmm. That's called responsive desire. Mm-hmm. We're no longer walking around with this spontaneous model. And it doesn't mean we're in the wrong relationship or you have the wrong partner. It just means you actually have to communicate more.
Sure. Now, what is this good enough sex model that I've heard about?
Yeah. So the good enough sex model was created by Barry McCarthy, Dr. Barry McCarthy and Dr. Michael Metz. And it's kind of... focuses on positive psychology and gender equity, going from like what we learned about sex and sexual arousal models of like male sexual response. Masters and Johnson's back in the 60s was based on a male. Mm-hmm. You know, there's four phases. There's like all of a sudden there's this, you're already excited, right? There's this erection. Uh-huh. And then you have this orgasm or plateau. You have a refractory period and maybe you are young enough and vital enough and whatever enough that you go and have this experience again. That's, and then they placed women on top of that. And that's a lot of research, unfortunately, is compiled like that. Mm-hmm. So, the good enough sex model was, I think Barry and Michael were of older age when they came up with it. And, It's going away from a pass-fail sexual experience to really opening up the space for playfulness, for, you know what, sometimes we're not going to have the same experience. A lot of couples will come and say, hey, we want to have an orgasm at the same time. And sometimes I'm like, why? if you're worried about someone else's orgasm and focusing on like them having an orgasm at the same time, like you're losing out on your own arousal. Like, I'm selfish. I'm like, I want to be yummy in my own experience. I'm like, if you want to like time yours on mine, go for it, you know, but that was part of like what I grew up with as well. Like, mm-hmm. you know, we have, you know, in men earlier, by the way, sorry, I missed out on male bodied folks, but they are taught too that they're supposed to be the end all be all, like make a woman have an orgasm and they're not, you know, they're machismo and, you know, and so, you know, it's these unfair models. So the good enough sex model just talks about, a lot of just breaking through the myths that we all grow up with. And it's based on, you know, more sexual facts and clear evidence-based sexual education that's given in the model that people feel more refreshed, connected. Mm-hmm. Variable sexual experiences are okay. If one person or nobody has an orgasm, that's okay. The only goal is this pleasure-oriented sex that we're going to have. Let's play. Let's get naked and play. Or maybe not. We're not naked. Let's just be sensual and play. You know, that can be sex. It's okay. But if you wanted to look it up, you know, there's, you know, so many tenets I could go on for hours and talk about it. But it's a lovely, compassionate model versus, you know, kind of what we're stuck with in our head, what mm-hmm. we judge ourselves on, and which keeps us from a lot of pleasure.
So basically you're saying that this idea of intimacy, we've been kind of conditioned to think it's this small little thing. This is what we have to do to be intimate. But in reality, it's much broader and there's a lot more things involved. Am I getting that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
And it starts way before you're doing anything sexually technical.
Okay.
It starts in the relationship. Mm-hmm. Do I feel cherished by you?
Yeah.
Do I feel safe with you? Do I feel like you have my back?
Mm-hmm.
Those are all prerequisites to inviting someone to fully emerge, to be let go, to have personal risk-taking in bed, to mm-hmm. actually have a healing, transformative experience through sexual intimacy, to have a transcendent experience, to let go of time and just, you know, giggle or cry or just not, just for any outcome to be okay, because that's you and I love you.
Mm-hmm.
And
So what are some of the tools and strategies that you give couples to help them reconnect, you know, on this more intimate level?
So many.
What are the basics? I mean, if I was coming to you the first time out, what would you do? What would you tell us?
Well, I probably wouldn't give you anything the first time out, okay, because I would have to I would have to ask you a lot of questions. Okay. So I knew I wasn't going to do any damage and invite you into a place that you weren't ready for. Mm-hmm. I was talking to Joel about this, how, like, you know, sensationalizing sex, Netflix shows, HBO, like, you know, these kinds of things. And it's, you know, you really need to be careful because they're editing a lot out of the micro steps that are needed for connection and for growth and for safety to go to those places. And so before I assign anything or invite people into anything, I need to establish that I'm not going to do any harm. Mm-hmm. But to answer your question, I give folks some bonding behaviors. There are 31 ways of being connected with one another that are sensual ways. They're little invitations of not being sexual. They have value just in themselves. They could take anywhere from 10 minutes to a half hour. The goal is not to get anybody revved up and ready for something, which is a lot of what some partners can feel and frankly are very turned off by. Sometimes I'll just ask people to start making out again, because what I find is couples will stop making out. One partner might stop making out because they think it's going to lead to intercourse, and they don't want it to lead it. They just want some yummy time, but they don't know how to share that. They're afraid of hurting their partner's feelings or afraid of hurting their partner's self-esteem. And so they don't do anything, or they might decide to, like, forego the make out, and then they have intercourse and it's a chore and they're lying there and they're just this vessel. And none of us want to be having any kind of intimacy with just a vessel. And they're not getting much out of it. We can tell if our partner, you know, really wants to be there or not. And so, you know, our partners really need to have the ability to say no when they want to say no, so they can have this exciting yes. And then you can be there for it, to witness it, to feel it, to experience it. But you have to be able to self-soothe. Every time your partner says no, I'm not in the mood, you can't act like a five-year-old. You can't pout. You can't decide not to pick up the kids from soccer. You say, you know, blah, da, 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 da. You know, that's passive aggressive. It's immature. And you need to grow up. And you need to have a discussion about it. Mm-hmm. Because obviously, if they were saying yes, they would feel like what was going on was good. And they felt safe. And, you know, And again, you're both a team. The other partner's responsibility is to share what they're needing and wanting if they're not getting it. As difficult as it may be, you have to take little steps. And it might take a long time, but it's worth it. It's worth feeling alive and connected and joyful and satisfied. And that satisfied, again, is not one way. Satisfaction can look so many different ways. It's very variable from one person to another, from one gender to another.
We're almost done, actually, with our half an hour. It went so quickly. But I know that a few times a year, you and your husband, Jason Eisenberg, facilitate intimacy workshops for couples. What are these workshops like? Is this like a weekend, or what's the basis on that?
So we facilitate two types of workshops. One is a 3-hour mini intimacy workshop where it's here in Madison. It's at the Quarry Arts Building where my private practice is. And it's limited to 8 couples, and we use the Imago Dialogue as a safety structure to discuss and move into, invite you into talking about intimacy, and we are very pleasure-oriented and not goal-directed, so it's very playful. There's sensual music. We do lots of breath work. You know, one of the components of Peggy Kleinpatt's work is being present and embodied and using your breath. If we aren't relaxed, we cannot have blood flow to our genitals. And to have more blood flow to our genitals, we feel more arousal. And so if we're anxious, we can't have blood flow to our genitals. So our intimacy workshops are very playful. And then our weekend-long weekend Imago relationship workshops. That's coming up in November mm-hmm. and also at the Christine Center in January. And those are based on the Imago Getting the Love You Want weekend workshop.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Margaret. We really, really appreciate you coming in. Margaret Berg is a certified relationship and sex therapist and workshop presenter.